Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
We're here in Washington, where, of course, we're keeping you updated on what we hear from the administration around the deal with Iran that is in the process of being negotiated and what we're hearing about that deal from those who are concerned here in D.C. That includes Senator Roger Wicker, who, of course, heads up important committee in the Senate that oversees the U.S. Armed Forces, who just told our colleagues on Capitol Hill that he doesn't think Iran deserves any sanctions relief, having already made clear that he has hesitations about what the U.S. is trying to do here diplomatically. But sanctions relief is what Iran has already received. We saw the waivers for Iranian energy exports for 60 days, the period, of course, of these negotiations. And now there is discussion on the unfreezing of assets. As Iran says, it will be having about $12 billion in assets in two tranches unfrozen. President Trump says the U.S. will control that, something that Iran disputes. And here's how the president answered to that in the Oval Office yesterday.
If the sanctions go out, money's going to be put into this country. All that money's coming back in the form of purchases of food, which they desperately need.
Can you assure that the Iranians won't use profits from oil sales to rebuild their military?
Well, they're not supposed to be doing that, so we'll see. But they're supposed to use money to buy food for their people.
Of course, Iran now says $12 billion in frozen funds set to be released, two installments, $6 billion each. That's coming from Iran, not the administration. And of course, that money was supposed to be tied to improved behavior, meeting certain milestones. And that's where we start with Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall, our Washington correspondent on the North Lawn of the White House. Are we hearing anything about this money today from the administration? Tyler, Iran makes it seem like the checks are already in the mail.
Well, Joe, at this point, we haven't gotten confirmation from this White House, including on the amount of Iranian assets that will be unfrozen. President Trump didn't have the chance to talk to press here before he headed out to Pennsylvania because there's a bad weather call due to the rain in Washington, D.C., so he just headed straight to Joint Base Andrews. We did get that post, though, as you mentioned, on Truth Social earlier today, where President Trump did seem to indicate that an unfreezing of Iranian assets will be in the pipeline, but that that money will only be tied towards going towards U.S. agricultural purchases. This is something that we heard the Iranian foreign minister dispute earlier today, saying that ultimately Iran will be able to, quote, freely use these assets as they wish. And we should point out that in the text of the memorandum of understanding, it is our understanding that it does designate that the Iranian Central Bank can specify the beneficiaries of these unfrozen funds. It's going to be just one of the threads that we watch moving forward here, where there seems to be some discrepancy, at least publicly, between the U.S. and Iran. As you mentioned, of course, this White House, though, has maintained that any such financial benefits will ultimately accrue over time. They will be based on progress. That includes this temporary sanction waiver that we are seeing for Iranian crude to hit the market. That is for that 60-day period for this extension of the ceasefire.
Yep. And of course, President Trump was pointing out 19 million barrels of oil flowing out of the Strait of Hormuz. Tyler, but there is a major question as to what happens after 60 days with the Strait specifically and whether or not there will be tolls, fees for administrative costs, whatever you want to call it. I would imagine that's something that the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is going to be discussing with other Gulf states on his trip this week.
Definitely, Kaylee. Also, when you look at analysis that shows us that if any such tolls were ultimately imposed in the Strait of Hormuz, our Gulf allies would be the ones paying the brunt of them. As we start to see, as you mentioned, these flows tick up. President Trump saying 19 million barrels crossed yesterday. That is in line with pre-conflict levels, closer to about 20 million barrels that used to pass per day before the war began. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has this regional tour. He's going to be in Kuwait, the UAE, and Bahrain. Of course, major producers trying to transit through the strait. Just yesterday, we had reporting from Bloomberg News that four empty LNG tankers were making their way back to Qatar in the largest number of such tankers that we've seen transit so far since the ceasefire began. Definitely going to be something to watch here. I'll also point out that, of course, Kaylee, the Secretary of State, is going to be trying to reassure our regional allies that the U.S. is pushing for those curbs when it comes to Iran's nuclear program. And the other big headline that we've been tracking today appears to be a discrepancy when it comes to the future of what inspections are going to look like, with Iran disputing that they made the concession that we could see inspections as soon as this week, according to President Trump.
All right, Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall live on the rainy north lawn of the White House on this Tuesday. Thank you so much. And of course, as we consider energy flowing out of the Strait of Hormuz, where prior to this conflict, a fifth of global energy supplies flowed out of, it, of course, is really the crux for the direction of oil prices. There was 20 million barrels a day, Joe, as you point out, prior to this conflict, each and every day that was flowing through the strait. And the question is whether or not we're going to be able to sustainably get back to those levels and see the kind of oil prices we saw prior to the launch of Operation Epic Fury.
19 million, to your point, as the president suggested on Truth Social. He calls that an all-time record, which clearly it's not. The IEA said we were at just over 20 million barrels a day at that point. But I'll tell you what, oil prices once again today are heading lower. We're at about $73 WTI, just shy of 77 for Brent, down almost one to a little more than 1% for both, despite the news. Really, nothing has actually changed other than the fact that we can say the strait is open.
Well, yes, and of course, that's something that President Trump wants to herald, as he points to the fact that oil prices are going lower, as he did in the Oval Office yesterday.
The way we're doing it, we have the opposite of a depression. We're doing really well. The numbers are incredible. The oil is at a level that nobody's ever seen before. Oil prices are way down. I think they're very comparable to what they were. We're setting records. We have the strongest economy we've ever had.
So for more on those oil prices specifically, we turn now to the president of the American Petroleum Institute, Mike Summers, who is here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Mike, welcome back to Bloomberg TV and radio.
Great to be with you.
API just put out a new energy security framework, American energy security framework. And part of this you have in there is working with allies in the Persian Gulf to accelerate opportunities to reduce reliance on the Strait of Hormuz. How quickly can that reliance be reduced, or are we already there due to the fact the strait was effectively closed for months?
It is not too early for us to start thinking about what we should do after this crisis is over, which is what our American Energy Security Framework is all about. It's about providing resilience for the energy system that clearly needs it. What we've seen over the course of the last 3 months with the strait being closed, of course, has been a price hike in oil. But at the same time, it's also shown us that there's a reckoning going on right now between where we get our energy and where we should be getting our energy. So the focus of our framework is really on three things: increasing supply here in the United States and throughout the world, building infrastructure that the world's going to need to move that energy, and finally, providing resilience to the existing energy structure. So what we're talking about is how do you build out infrastructure, not just here in the United States, but also in the Middle East, so that we don't have to traverse the strait as much as we currently do to get the products that Americans need every single day.
Okay, Mike, so let's walk through a couple of these, because your timing here is critical as we have just lived through this extended closure of the strait. And it starts here at home with regard to securing the energy supply. You've got a couple of ideas, including upgrading the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. What do we need to do?
So the Strategic Petroleum Reserve was actually developed in the late 1970s in response to the last Iranian oil crisis.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This was Henry Kissinger's big concept coming out of that crisis. We also formed the International Energy Agency at that time. So the SPR has not been upgraded since the late 1970s and early 1980s.
Damaged, right?
It's been damaged. In fact, every time you withdraw oil from the SPR, the infrastructure slowly breaks down. So it is in desperate need of upgrading. And what we're suggesting is we need to upgrade the SPR. We need to get the engineering right. Currently, it is supposed to be able to deliver about 4.5 million barrels of oil a day from it. It hasn't during this crisis. It's only delivered about 1 million barrels a day because the engineering needs to be upgraded significantly.
Wow.
Well, just one more question on the SPR before we move on here. It also needs to be refilled, infrastructure aside. It's hit the lowest level in 43 years. And I just
wonder how quickly you really anticipate we can do that and how it's going to compete with demand from other countries who are also trying to rebuild their own stockpiles and with just the daily needs in this country and everywhere else.
Well, I'd also remind you that we entered this crisis at very low levels of the SPR because it was used during the previous administration, right. Not because we were in an energy security dilemma, but really because they wanted to lower prices going into midterm elections. So we cannot be using the SPR for political purposes. It has to be in times of energy security crises, which is what we've seen over the course of the last few months. We're at record lows now because of the near 9 million barrels a week that we have been withdrawing from it. So it is now is the time, particularly when we're dealing with, you know, lower prices. We should start thinking about upgrading the reserve and how we refill it in a timely manner.
Really interesting. That includes as well new offshore leasing, expanded access in the Gulf, and ensuring reliable fuel supply through what you call a functional renewable fuel standard. What is that?
Well, currently, the renewable fuel standard, which of course is the way we provide ethanol or put ethanol in gasoline, what we've actually proposed is a system where we're no longer providing what are called small refinery exemptions to mid-sized refiners, which is essentially a bailout to refiners that, you know, aren't able to function with the RFS in place. And in exchange for a relook at the RFS, we're proposing that we actually have E15, ethanol, 15% ethanol within the gasoline fleet. So this is a proposal that has made its way through the United States House of Representatives. It's something that the United States Senate should consider now as well.
Mm-hmm. I would just point out that President Trump just touched down in Pennsylvania, where he'll be speaking later this afternoon. He's gaggling with reporters right now, and if he brings any newsworthy comments, we will bring that to our audience. But of course, this is a president in Pennsylvania, which obviously is a robust energy state in many ways. It is a president who campaigned in part on drill, baby, drill, unleashing American energy, cutting regulatory red tape, and permitting reform is part of that. It's also one of your ideas here. This is a discussion it feels like we've been having in Washington forever.
For decades.
Is this time any different?
I certainly hope so. And I give the president a lot of credit for focusing on American production. We're now producing more oil and natural gas than we ever have in the history of this country. And by the way, the more oil and gas than any country has ever produced in the history of the world. And a lot of that has to do with the president's policies that he's advanced. But the one big thing that's missing is comprehensive permitting reform done by Congress in a bicameral way. Mm-hmm. So we're working with both sides of the aisle to get this accomplished. And I will say, President Trump has done everything that he can do from the executive branch, and the courts have done everything that they've done with three major Supreme Court decisions. Mm-hmm. The only branch that hasn't acted is Congress. But we're hopeful that in the month of July, with the negotiators that are at the table now, including Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia and Martin Heinrich from New Mexico and Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island, that the Senate can actually finally pass a bill that gets enacted into law.
Well, to your point, after all the talk, that would be quite a moment. Mike, strengthening resilience and supply chains, you point out, and I think Kaylee already highlighted this, working with allies in the Gulf to accelerate opportunities that reduce reliance on the Strait of Hormuz. After everything we just went through, what do we need? More pipe, more storage, or just staying away from that part of the world?
Well, here is the key. If it weren't for the infrastructure that the Saudis and the Emiratis put into place in advance of this crisis, we would be in a much different position. Prices would be much higher. Thankfully, they put in a major pipeline, the East-West pipeline through Saudi, another major pipeline through UAE. Both of them are talking about expanding those pipelines right now as lifelines to get around the Strait of Hormuz. I expect that investment's going to continue. Hmm. What I'm suggesting and what API is suggesting in this plan is that to the extent that they need assistance in building out that infrastructure, the Export-Import Bank and other resources here from the federal level should be there, because we're still very reliant on, and the world is reliant on those products that are coming out of the Arabian Gulf. So that's one idea that we've advanced. But in addition to that, I think we need to really focus on advancing Western Hemisphere energy. That means, yes, ensuring that we have the resources that we need here in the United States, in places like Alaska and North Dakota, and of course the prolific Permian Basin and the Gulf of America. But in addition to that, there are huge oil plays happening right here in the Western Hemisphere that are very exciting. Exxon and Chevron, for example, are in Guyana. Argentina is increasingly becoming an important play. Venezuela. That where we were only importing about 100,000 barrels a day from Venezuela before we went in to get Maduro, now we're importing almost 500,000 barrels a day. Wow. That's where we should focus, on the North-South alliance, not the East-West alliance.
Well, I'm glad you can come talk to us about all of this, Mike. This is a critical timing here as we try to figure out the next chapter in this whole story. He's the president of the American Petroleum Institute, Mike Summers. We thank you, as always, with some headlines coming from the president on the tarmac again. He says, we will talk voter ID bill with Republican lawmakers tomorrow, knowing that he is going to be headed to the Hill tomorrow on a busy day for the president, adding there is no rush to get inspectors on the ground in Iran. Much more to follow here on Bloomberg as we assemble our political panel next.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Before we leave the markets, do want to note the red headline that just crossed the Bloomberg terminal. SpaceX set to raise $25 billion from its debut high-grade bond sale. This is after we saw $89 billion in demand for this debt offering. Interestingly, SpaceX is rebounding today after a couple days of losses. The stock right now is up about 6% on the day. But this just underscores, Joe, the massive amount of capital that is going to be required for SpaceX to actually deliver on what it promised investors in that IPO prospectus. This notion of orbital data centers and everything else, you're going to need a lot of money to do that and to finance it. In part, they're obviously tapping the debt markets even after raising billions of dollars in their IPO.
Asteroid mining is still the part that I'm looking forward to. But yeah, every time we question whether the money is going to be there, the money shows up. And to think that the stock is catching a bid right now is also interesting, up 6%. We'll keep tabs on SpaceX throughout the day. Micron is still hurting ahead of earnings tomorrow, down sharply at 10, actually make it 11% loss here, which is the reason, one reason at least, why we're seeing pretty big losses on the NASDAQ. NVIDIA down 3% now too.
Yeah, so maybe today is not a day when President Trump is going to be touting record stock markets, although that won't necessarily stop him from doing so. But he is going to talk about the economy in Pennsylvania, where he just touched down. It's an event that is going to be focused in part on affordability and gas prices, I would imagine, as he's visiting a Mack Trucks facility. But this is part of the affordability tour, right? What the White House promised the president 100%. Was going to be focused on at the start of this year, a midterm election year.
The president leaving the bubble once again. This is his fifth visit to Pennsylvania, which is remarkable. McCungee is the name of the town, a suburb of Allentown, where the Mack truck plant is. And yeah, diesel prices are a pretty big deal there. So we'll be curious to hear how he frames affordability, which he has described as a Democrat hoax, having said recently in the Oval Office that he loves the inflation. Of course, he's going to be joined as well by somebody who could use the help. Congressman Ryan McKenzie, Republican in Lehigh Valley, was already speaking at that event. The president should be there shortly, Kaylee, as we assemble our political panel for their thoughts on the message of affordability today and the impact of everything that we have been talking about with regard to geopolitics. Bloomberg Politics contributors Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano join. Rick is our Republican strategist and partner at Stonecourt Capital. Jeannie, our Democratic analyst and democracy visiting fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Ash Center. What will be the message from the president today, Rick? He's been focused on talks with Iran. He's been focused on the reflecting pool and other items here, including a UFC fight in Washington and the big MAGA rally this week. He has to come down to the message of affordability once again, however. What will it be today?
Well, I would think that the White House would want him talking about the housing bill that's making its way in a bipartisan fashion through the House and Senate to land on his desk. Should be front and center as an accomplishment of his administration, the Republican Party. To get that done. Bipartisanship is not a bad thing to be talking about in Pennsylvania. It's one of the rare states that still has a split Senate delegation, just a couple left in the country that's not either all red or all blue. And it portends the kind of district that the president's going to be in today. As you mentioned, you know, Ryan McKenzie in a tough toss-up kind of election that could be very, very important to the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives. But he's probably distracted. He's going to meet with the Senate leadership and the caucus tomorrow for lunch, and going to be talking about that crazy Save America bill that he's holding the Senate hostage over. And I bet you he makes a case for it today, too.
Well, yeah, and he talked about that with reporters when he landed at the airport, Jeannie, talking about the fact that at that luncheon tomorrow with Senate Republicans, he is going to talk about the Save America Act. When we consider the audience that he'll find in Pennsylvania today, how much is that what voters really want to be hearing from the president about? Is that the right message to be bringing?
In one word, no. And, you know, I'm just listening to Rick, and you can see the White House poll team putting the president in a position to say and do all the right things. It's a critical district in a critical state. The focus has got to be on the economy. And yet, Kaylee, I look at his Truth Social, and I looked about 15 minutes ago, and the last four posts were about, guess what? The reflecting pool. And this sort of just summarizes where the president's head is versus where the poll teams, people like Rick Davis, and, you know, voters really want him to be, which is talking about things like the housing bill that is passing, as Rick mentioned, talking more importantly even about the economy, about inflation. And I think we can't forget that this plant he's visiting, same one that Joe Biden visited, is one in which they were hit not just as a result of what's happened in Iran, but also his favorite word, tariffs. And all of that has cost them jobs, and all of that has cost him support, especially among white, non-college educated voters who voted for him by like 65% in the 2024 election. But the latest polls in Pennsylvania show they're now down to about 39%, which is better than the average American poll, but still a huge problem for Republicans and a huge problem for Donald Trump.
Well, so we come back around to the same kind of questions every time he hits the road, Rick. Is it more important for Donald Trump to be out and in person regardless of the message? Or would Susie Wiles rather keep him in the White House if he's not going to talk about affordability?
Well, I do think Susie Wiles declared at the beginning of this election cycle that no matter what they do, this election is going to be about Donald Trump. So they might as well lean into it and try and influence it. And at that point in time, they declared they would be out talking about affordability, about cost of living every single week. And that was 12 weeks ago, and they've been out five times. So I know there's been a lot going on. You know, you got wars in the Middle East and all kinds of other issues. But at a time when, you know, Republicans are really down and out and the president's image is at one of the lowest levels in history, you would think that they would try to stick to a schedule that keeps the president out and about, because I don't think it's avoidable. I think Susie Wiles is right. This is going to be about Donald Trump no matter what they want. And if he's going to go out and sell, he's got to sell. But he can't talk about reflecting pools, and he can't talk about ballrooms, and he can't talk about arches, and he can't talk about all this stuff that voters could not care less about and actually get angry when they hear him talking about it.
Well, so if you're Ryan McKenzie, Rick, a swing district Republican, is it wise to be aligning yourself with the president in this way, headlining an event together?
Again, he's stuck, right? He doesn't have any choice. He looks at his numbers and says, if I don't get the base MAGA vote out, I'm toast. Mike Lawler did it with Trump the other day. I mean, could not have a more independent Republican in a state that absolutely shouldn't have Donald Trump around him. But, you know, he saw the base and he realized, if I lose the base, I lose the election. And I think McKenzie is looking at the same construction. The reality is you can't get any kind of swing voters if you lose your base, right? It doesn't matter. So you got to start with the basics. And that's where we are the summer before the midterms, is worrying about the basics.
Well, interesting. I suspect that Ryan McKenzie is also thinking about these numbers today in the Washington Post, Jeannie, and I'm curious how you're looking at this. An analysis by the Post finds Americans are voting in Democratic primaries and in special elections this year in far greater numbers than we've seen before. 12.6 million ballots cast in Democratic House primaries versus 8.6 million in Republican ones. We don't want to read too far into this, but I'm wondering how you see that playing out in the general.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned this, Joe, because this is a critical, critical issue in the midterm, which is enthusiasm and turnout, as Rick was just talking about. And we are seeing this writ large. The Washington Post story you just referenced today is a really good example. We also saw the latest Marist poll, and the latest Marist poll shows that among Republicans, Donald Trump still has large approval, but the strength and the enthusiasm of approval among Republicans as it pertains to Trump has declined over 12 points in a year. So it's not that, you know, members of the GOP are saying, oh, we don't like Trump and you know, we're going to go Democratic. Not by any means. It's that you're just not as enthusiastic because what they're seeing around them and the problem for people like in this district in McKenzie is that they won't be enthusiastic enough to show up. And so that's what Donald Trump really has to work on out there. And he's got to work on it by talking about things that people care about. And, you know, I just want to go back to this manufacturing site. This is a place that at its height, like the late 70s, they had like 19 point something million workers in the manufacturing sector. It's now down to 12. That has nothing to do literally with Donald Trump and Iran and tariffs in the last few years. These are systemic issues. And one thing the Republicans and Trump and Democrats could do is talk about how you're going to address this in a concerted way in the face of AI, in the face of automation, and so many other things. We aren't hearing any of that by either side.
Just quickly, Jeannie, on this notion around strong Democratic turnout, if the Save America Act were to pass as the president wants with voter ID, with restrictions on mail-in balloting, what would the net effect of that be on who gets to turn out or who is driven to turn out in the midterms?
You know, I think that it may even out because I think if they pass that, you may see the Democratic base more upset than they already are and turn out in larger numbers despite that. And Republicans may see a drop off because it impacts things like early voting, mail-in balloting. That's why so many Republicans in the House and the Senate are scratching their head and saying, no, Mr. President, please don't. This negatively impacts us in an election that's going to be all about turnout. And of course, in the end, the American public writ large lose because this is going to disenfranchise voters. And that is a horrible problem.
Of course, there is very little likelihood that it actually can pass as the filibuster in the Senate at this point remains intact. Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis, our political panel today, thank you so much. And of course, we'll be talking a lot more about that particular push from the president and the push back from Senate Republicans tomorrow when he visits the Hill for lunch with senators, Joe.
That should be quite a doozy to be a fly on the wall, as they say. John Cornyn might be thinking hard about his message. We're going to turn back to the market straight ahead and see how we're faring in the Tuesday trade. Alongside Kaylee Lyons, I'm Joe Matthew.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
With another check on the markets here, it's not been a lot of fun if you're in the tech space, although there have been some areas of light. Software, for instance, is getting a bid, but to Amy's point, chips are falling hard. And boy, when they go down fast. Micron is losing now 12%, $139, having run up significantly ahead of earnings tomorrow after the bell. Nvidia also lower, down 3%. There have been some areas of life, as I mentioned. Kaylee, McDonald's is getting a bid. GE, we're seeing healthcare get some love. But the tech sell-off started overnight in South Korea. Yep. That's the real story here. We're not trading so much on Iran today. Mm-hmm. The KOSPI, that was a freakout, 10% lower. Its worst day since March 4th. Look no further than SK Hynix, Samsung. You know where we're going. Mm-hmm. It's these memory stocks, Kaylee, for better or worse, that seem to be driving the market.
Yeah, certainly so, and in the negative direction today. So let's get more on this as we turn to Bloomberg TV markets correspondent Nora Melinda. So, Nora, obviously, we have seen incredible moves in these names. Yes, we saw them to the upside. Now we're seeing it to the downside, it seems. Is this just once again that rotation out of these stocks into more cyclical areas of the market?
Absolutely. That's what I'm hearing from the sources that I'm speaking with, especially when you think about the performance of a lot of these big names, these big mega cap companies. The biggest winners on the year now turning out to be some of the biggest laggards on the day. Now, a lot of people are really concerned about, of course, artificial intelligence. That's really been the conversation here. We're seeing fresh questions really being raised, and you're seeing that sell-off really ricocheting from, as you mentioned, Korea over into the U.S. So I'm also taking a look at the SOX index that tracks a lot of those Philadelphia semiconductor names, down about 7.3%. So many names lower as a lot of investors really rush for the exit outside of this sector.
Interesting to see some of the ancillary stocks too, like Caterpillar, that was getting a lot of love as it was suddenly considered an AI stock. SpaceX, though, is doing better, Nora, and I'm wondering what you're seeing and hearing about this. The stock catches a bid after actually trading below its debut price. It's now up 5%, $162, and the company's raising billions now in the bond market.
We are seeing SpaceX seeking to raise about $25 billion in its first investment-grade bond sale. You're seeing some investor appetite here. What's interesting, though, when we think about the sell-off that we were seeing in SpaceX over the last couple of days, what I'm hearing from the sources that I'm speaking with is that there were so many people across the globe, if they actually were interested in SpaceX, they've already bought SpaceX. So you are seeing this in a certain way as the seller's market. So today it's interesting to see this rebound as a lot of the market is really digesting what this means, because fears were essentially percolating before about the fact that whether or not this company is taking on too much debt, especially as we think about the fact of all these large tech companies just taking on more and more money, taking on more and more debt. And investors are really just thinking about whether or not they're actually going to be able to see some return on investment, a product on the other side of this.
Well, yeah, it's a good point, Nora, this idea that so many of the hyperscalers of a lot of these AI-oriented companies are having to come raise more money in debt markets specifically. If the demand is there for now, what sense are you getting as to how long it is going to be able to hold up, and whether this tranche of debt offerings that we're seeing is going to be it for a while for that reason?
And that's the question here. I mean, you're talking about appetite. We've seen about $90 billion of orders already pouring in as we think about this bond sale for SpaceX. So the question is whether or not we're going to continue to see this appetite, this fervor, all these people coming behind SpaceX, or whether or not we're going to start to see a little bit of attention going toward other companies that are also in the tech space. But for right now, SpaceX certainly has everybody's attention.
Nora, thank you. As always, she's live in New York. Nora Melinda, Bloomberg Markets correspondent, with us on Balance of Power. It's a primary day, and everything we're talking about, the wealth effect or lack thereof from the stock market, the impact of energy prices, gas now back below $4 a gallon, all playing into decisions that are being made in several states, including New York. And we're going to zero in on some of these races, but also talk about the issues that are driving decisions today with Daniel Squadron, former New York State Senator, a Democrat, co-founder of the States Project, as well author of the new book, The Fourth Branch. Daniel, it's great to have you with us as part of our conversation today on Bloomberg TV and radio. And I'd like to start broadly with that issue of affordability that the president's going to be talking about a short time from now, once again in Pennsylvania, not holding primaries today, but very much important on the map of swing states as we make our way toward the midterms and then, of course, 2028. When it comes to the impact of gas prices, energy prices that have been so important, and diesel is key to the Mack truck facility that the president is going to be speaking at, combined with the wealth effect from the stock market, which is not enjoyed by all Americans. How do we rationalize these two as the billionaire president speaks to a room full today?
Well, look, I think it's going to be a real challenge because it's no longer a hot take. In fact, it's almost a stale one, that people feel like things cost too much. And the spike in the gas prices is one for folks who are air travelers. It's a second. But of course, this goes back to groceries and housing. And, the idea that this is a thing where you can ask people to not trust their lying eyes just doesn't work. There's no amount of political rhetoric or conversation that's going to change people's fundamental math, the math that families across America do every 2 weeks when the paycheck comes in and they try to balance that against their checkbook.
Mm-hmm. Well, so obviously we spend a lot of time talking about how affordability politics are going to play for one party relative to another, Republicans who are currently in power in Washington versus Democrats. And I'm sure that will be on display in some of the swingier districts in New York, like Mike Lawler's, who will learn what Democrat he is up against after today's primary. But for the city, where it's just Democrats against Democrats, how is the messaging around these kind of issues differing inside of the party?
Well, look, in New York City, I'd say gas prices themselves are probably not as central an issue as in some other places. But the impacts of gas prices, because people pay extremely high utility mm-hmm. bills, it goes into how well and how affordably the mass transit system runs. And of course, housing. When you talk about a city like New York, where people from around the country want to live there and try to make a life, as the house, just about the highest housing costs or close to it in the country, is still a major, major issue. I think what is sometimes missed, though, is that in primaries in a place like New York, it really comes down to the individual candidates much more than the national narrative we try to put on it. Who has the personal credibility and relationship in that Democratic primary district to convince folks on many of these same issues that are national, but in a very local way?
Sink your teeth into the 12th congressional district then, Forrest Daniel. This is a doozy. It's a big personality contest, you could argue. And I realize that there are some other elements, including AI spending, which is a really interesting factor here. But you've got a Kennedy and Jack Schlossberg. You've got George Conway, a star from cable news, all vying to replace Jerry Nadler here. Alex Boris is the one that has drawn that AI money, as he's calling for additional regulations. How much of a personality contest is this versus a policy one?
And of course, you have Assembly Member Micah Lasher, who has a career of public service working for the former Mayor Bloomberg, Governor Hochul, and others. I think it is really interesting to see how, in part, certainly when you talk about Assembly Member Boris, it's become a proxy war for large AI companies. You have some in favor, some opposed. And my hope is, as a New Yorker and as someone who really believes in representative democracy and a relationship between elected officials and the voters, is that that proxy war isn't what defines the outcome. What defines the outcome, I would hope, would be how well in this marquee district in America each of these candidates is seen to represent their constituents. Certainly the future of AI regulation, AI's impact on jobs, the siting of data centers are all important public policy issues. But in New York City, as I talked about before, housing, public transit, safe streets, better schools are as well. And there's no national proxy war on that stuff, but I do hope that's what the voters end up focusing on.
Well, and of course, it was messaging around those issues to voters that ultimately got Zohran Mamdani elected as mayor of New York as a Democratic socialist. And he is a player in this game today, having endorsed against incumbents in the 10th district and the 13th district. And I just wonder how you're viewing this test, frankly, of his power in New York as he goes up against the man who could be the next Speaker of the House in Hakeem Jeffries.
Well, look, first of all, you win a big election like mayor of New York City. I don't think there's actually anything that surprising about the fact that you would then go and try to get some more allies in office. I think what's going to be really interesting here is if it's a confusing outcome where, some of the incumbents win, some of the folks endorsed by the mayor win. As I said, in the 12th district, I think you could write 13 different stories about how it comes out. Mm-hmm. My fear is that it gets oversimplified into some national narrative, because that really isn't how we should be looking at primaries within a party. We should be looking at it as a temperature check on what's happening with the base of the party first. But second, and I think more important, and this is why I focus all of my time on states, it's really a way to look at how well folks are representing their communities. General elections are about the large partisan conversation often, but these primaries are really about these individuals.
Mm-hmm. Your book, as we mentioned, The Fourth Branch, How State Government Can Save Our Union. Incidentally, forward by Sarah Jessica Parker. Is that true? She did the audio book for you?
Yes, the incredibly talented actor and book judge. Yes, really honored to have worked with her.
Good job.
She's as engaged in this as I think everyone should be.
Well, I'll tell you, Daniel, the thesis in the book is fascinating, and I wonder what you make of the current argument here in Washington about AI regulation, because we have found great passions on both sides of this debate, whether there should be a federal standard or a state-by-state sort of patchwork of AI regulations that critics say would, in fact, hold the technology at bay and might cause the U.S. to lose the so-called AI race. Is artificial intelligence the biggest challenge to the fourth branch?
It's certainly not the biggest challenge. And I think it's actually something that has been anticipated when you talk about the power of states in a lot of ways. What's one thing we know about AI, you've been talking about it all morning as people watch the markets, is a lot is still unknown. You're going to need a dynamic policymaking framework as this develops. Now, look, I am a Democrat, as you said. I think that federal action is appropriate and warranted. We just don't get a lot of it. And so if the federal government steps into this arena and says, we've got it, what that's going to mean is a lot of stagnation as the world changes faster than maybe we've ever seen before. The great thing about our federal system, we have 51 different independent, powerful jurisdictions. Obviously, in a fast-moving time, knowing that government catching up to the private sector can sometimes be a challenge, there's mm-hmm. no perfect answer. But I'm really excited that in this country, we have 51 different chances to get AI regulation right.
All right. The author of the new book, The Fourth Branch, and former state senator in New York, Daniel Squadron, thanks for being with us on this early edition of Balance of Power.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.